Somebody asked a question about a comment I made regarding immigration as a factor here in the financial problems, because of course in one sense we're all immigrants, we all came from somewhere, our ancestry came from somewhere. Of course I'm a recent immigrant. I was born in the UK. I've only been an American citizen for 8 years. I've lived here for 14 years. But I want to refer you to an article in a recent issue of the American Conservative magazine. And it was an article written by a journalist in Southern California who was writing prior to the vote which resulted in Arnold Schwarzenegger becoming the governor of California. Now, I quoted from this article in a recent issue of World News and Prophecy, so I leave you to do the research if you want to read it. But the point of the article was this: California's financial crisis is due to a simple fact. That is that 5% of the population, the Anglos in California, pay roughly 72%, I think it was, of the taxes. And many of the people who've moved into California over the past 20 or 30 years, coming from South American countries, are the consumers of the taxes. They are the ones who are receiving various benefits. They often have lots of children and, you know, they need Medicare and so on. So he said, as the Anglos retire and move out of California, so the tax base declines, the tax revenue declines, but as more people move in from South America, so the expenditure increases. This is the reason for California's fiscal crisis. And you know, that demographic trend is going to continue, so it's not going to improve. This was exactly the same situation you had in Africa with independence, that as the British moved out of the country, so the tax revenues would decrease, but in most British colonies in Africa, within 5 years, the first 5 years of independence, half the British left, so tax revenue went down, but government would double the number of people working in the government, so they spent twice as much, which is a recipe for disaster, you see. And some of these things, just happen because of cultural differences and because of other factors. I mean, I gave the example of AIDS, for example, the man who works for the federally funded AIDS program in Michigan, telling me that people can come from all over the world. And, you know, they come with a round-trip ticket because they're only coming to visit the U.S. When they get here, they don't leave. They stay here because they can get free care as somebody with AIDS, because the gay lobby is so powerful in the U.S. And, you know, that's what's led to these laws. And so consequently, they're able to stay, but that pushes up the costs of these programs. We've really got to cover a lot, so can we wait for questions till the end? I want to show you how 911 fits into all of this, okay? It's important that we see this, because 911 was seen by many people as the beginning of something, and I want to show you that it is part of an historic continuum. Benjamin Netanyahu, who was the Prime Minister of Israel a few years ago, made the statement that we are in a war to reverse the triumph of the West. Remember, the West for the last 250 years has been dominated by the biblical tribe of Joseph. So we have implanted upon the world our standards. Of course, most countries have not followed those standards historically, but we have pretty much created the world as it is today. And there has been a war to reverse the triumph of the West. If we can go back to the first map, if Daniel could just do that for me, or somebody could do that. See, this is the world in 1946. You see how Joseph dominated the world. The United States, which at the end of World War II was the preeminent military power, the British Empire, all those countries colored red, which was still there in 1946. So we dominated the world. Now, try and keep this map in mind. But since 1946, with decolonization, as the British dismantled their empire, remember what James Truslow Adams said would happen if the British Empire fell? All the wild winds of anarchy, of despotism, of spiritual oppression would rush in to fill the vacuum. And that's exactly what's happened. Let's look at the Middle East, the next map. In fact, I can use this, can't I, to move on here. Okay. Here was the British Empire in the Middle East. You see how the British effectively controlled the Middle East for the decades in between World War I and World War II, after which they started to dismantle their empire. The British kept the lid on problems in the Middle East. Look at Palestine, for example, in the top left-hand corner, what we today call Israel. And of course, there's also the West Bank, where the Palestinians live, which is now being ruled by Israel. But before the establishment of the nation of Israel in 1948, this was British territory. And the British tried to keep the Jews and the Palestinians from, you know, fighting each other. Eventually, they found they couldn't cope, and in 1948, Israel was given independence as the British pulled out of that area. And when the British pulled out of Iraq, eventually that led to Saddam Hussein taking power in Iraq. The British had a dominant presence in Iran, which is not on the map. It's the next one over to the right from Iraq. The British had a very dominant presence in Iran until the early 1950s, and then things changed there as well. But we've seen a considerable change in the Middle East. Let's look at the next map here, okay? You see here the modern Middle East. This map is actually a few years old, but here's all the countries once the British had left. Remember, when the British lost the Suez Canal in 1956, they realized their empire was finished. And that's when they pulled out of their empire. That's when they gave up all these territories. Between 1956 and 1964, just about everything that Britain ruled around the world was given independence in a short period of time. And all these new countries came into existence. You see a lot of these countries there. Some of them came into existence earlier in the Middle East, just after World War II. But you see how much more complicated the Middle East has become as a result of the British Empire, because as a result of the end of the British Empire. Because now you've got all these new nations there. And some of those nations do not get along with each other, and there's been a continual state of turmoil in the Middle East. Remember, I quoted to you a while ago, in the early part of the 1900s, how this was the most boring part of the world, nothing ever happened here. That's what was said in 1910. Look at it now. This is the most volatile part of the world, and it's the most dangerous part of the world. So things have changed a great deal. Now, again, this is part of an historic continuum, and we need to understand that, okay? We need to go back to the 7th century. To the 7th century, when Mr. Regan was born. This is showing the expansion of Islam. In 570 AD, Muhammad was born. In 610, I believe it was, he started receiving his visions. And that led to the establishment of the Islamic religion. He died in 632. By the end of that century, everything colored green there had been conquered by the Muslims. Now, Islam began right down here in Mecca and Medina, in this part of Arabia. Look how big the Islamic Empire had become by the end of the century, in just 7 or 8 decades. In the next century, the Muslims took over the whole of the Iberian Peninsula and got right up here to the gates of Paris, where they were finally defeated by Charles Martel in 732. He was an ancestor of Charlemagne. That, you know, led eventually to Charlemagne reestablishing the Roman Empire in 800 AD. But all of this colored green here was the Empire of Islam. Now, if you look at your Bible, you'll see something interesting here. Genesis chapter 16. Genesis chapter 16. You know, the Arab peoples know that they are descended from Ishmael. And this is a prophecy regarding Ishmael in Genesis 16, where the angel of the Lord says to Hagar, "Behold, you are with child, and you shall bear a son. You shall call his name Ishmael, because the Lord has heard your affliction. He shall be a wild man. His hand shall be against every man, and every man's hand against him. And he shall dwell in the presence of his brethren. When you look at this area, which we now call Saudi Arabia, right down here, the tribes, the Arab tribes, were constantly killing each other for centuries prior to Muhammad. Muhammad was the first person to unite all of these tribes, and he united them with the common religion of Islam, which they then took to all these other territories as well. And as they conquered these territories, you know, people were given a choice. Either they could convert or they could die. And they were killed if they didn't convert. Now, if you were Christians or Jews, they did allow you to remain as Christians and Jews, because the teaching was that Christians and Jews are followers of a former revelation, I think is the term that is used. People of the book is the way that it's sometimes translated, but followers of a former revelation, meaning that the revelations to Muhammad were later revelations. Christians and Jews could continue to live and practice their religion, but they had to pay a special tax when they came under Islam, which Muslims did not have to pay. And if you look at the Quran, and the purpose of this lecture is not to go into details of Islam and Islamic beliefs, but if you look at the Quran, you'll find that there were all kinds of discriminatory laws against Christians and Jews. For example, if a Muslim killed a Christian or a Jew, he would not be punished. But if he killed another Muslim, he would be executed. And if a Muslim went to court and testified against a Christian or a Jew, then his word would be taken against that of the Christian or the Jew. So there were discriminatory laws. But Christians and Jews, you know, did exist within, you know, the Islamic Empire. But others had to convert to Islam. And Islam became a very fast-growing religion. Now, you know, these areas that speak Arabic, you know, are generally considered Arab countries, although the real Arabs are, you know, here. But Islam got into other areas that were not Arabs. The Arabs are descended from Ishmael, and here is this prophecy: he shall be a wild man, and his hand shall be against every man. And this certainly has been the case with the Arab peoples, and also with you know, the religion of Islam. It's very, you know, violent, very aggressive, very contentious, and there is constant conflict throughout this region in the Middle East, just constant conflict. Now, what kept the lid on this for a long time was that the Turkish Empire ruled over these areas for a long time and kept control of it, and that's why 100 years ago the area was at peace. Let's look at the next map. Here is the Turkish Empire, called the Ottoman Empire. The rulers were the Ottomans, and this is the Ottoman Empire from 1299 to 1692. That's a long period of time. Ruled all of this colored purple here. You see how far it got into Europe? This empire got right to the gates of Vienna a couple of times. Vienna, right in the heart of Europe. And, you know, the Turks controlled all of this. It was a big empire. 1672, it was at its height, and then it started to decline. Uh-oh, I went too far. Can I go back one? Okay, this is the decline of the Ottoman Empire. All of these colored areas were a part of the Ottoman Empire in 1699, but gradually the empire was pulling back, and these areas broke away in the years where, you know, the date is given, like Libya, 1912, I can't see that one there. And in the Balkans, the Ottoman Empire was pulling back all through the 19th century. And by the time of World War I, the Ottoman Empire sided with Germany and Austria against Britain and France and Russia. And of course, they lost, as a result of which their empire collapsed. And that's when the British and the French were given control of some of these territories in the Middle East. So this is your background to 911, okay? So this then became the British Empire in the Middle East. Now, let's continue here as well. See the next map here? That's the modern Middle East, okay. Now, I want to show you something here. Can we just go back again a second, because I want to save that one for a little bit later time, okay? If you look at Luke chapter 21, you'll see that Jerusalem was to be the center of world conflict at the end. Verse 20, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation is near. Then let those in Judea flee to the mountains. Let those who are in the midst of her depart. Let not those who are in the country enter her. For these are the days of vengeance, that all things which are written may be fulfilled. You can look at other prophecies in the Old Testament, in Zechariah, for example, that show that Jerusalem, the Middle East, would be a major area of contention at the end. We saw that in the book of Revelation as well, how all these armies come together and there's the final battle. This is going to be the center of everything. This would not have happened if the Turkish Empire had continued, because the Turks kept control of this whole area, and the Jews were there, also the Arabs were there, and everybody lived fairly peacefully, not completely. There was terrible atrocities against groups like the Armenians, and in the Balkans, they treated a lot of people very badly. But in the area of Palestine, the Jews, the Arabs, and the Turks seemed to live fairly peacefully. But all this came to an end with World War I, and then things changed significantly. Now, if we could go back to the first map again, I just want to show here. So what is the background then to September the 11th? Well, again, this is the map in 1946. Realize that after 1946, and especially after the loss of the Suez Canal, the British Empire was dismantled. And in the Middle East, the British Empire was dismantled too. Okay? So this meant that the tribe of Joseph was in decline. As Benjamin Netanyahu says, the West's fortunes have been reversed in the past half century. We've been in retreat for half a century. Now, because Americans tend to forget about the British Empire, it's possible to look at the last 50 years of American domination and think that everything's been remaining the same. But in actual fact, it hasn't been. Because of the decline of the British Empire and its fall, there has been this reversal of the fortunes of the West. And many conflicts have resulted, just as James Truslow Adams said would happen with the fall of the British Empire, so conflicts have arisen around the world, and America has often had to get involved in some of those conflicts to try to keep the peace. But progressively, it's all been unraveling over the past 50 or 60 years. Now, some turning points were these. After World War II, we saw the establishment of the nation of Israel, the Jewish nation of Israel in 1948. Immediately Israel came into existence. It was surrounded by five Arab armies. There were only 500,000 Jews at that time. Five armies tried to destroy the nation of Israel as soon as it was born. And it led to what the Israelis called the War of Independence. And they had to really fight hard for the first few months in order to preserve their very existence as a nation. But they won. As a result of their victory, people in neighboring countries got upset that here was a Jewish state on what was considered Islamic land. And in 1952, this led to a coup in Egypt. The king of Egypt, King Farouk, was overthrown by the military. The military blamed the king, who was rather a decadent playboy. He was blamed for the defeat against Israel and the humiliation of the Egyptian army. Egypt was huge, with millions of people, and couldn't defeat this small Jewish country. And there were five countries that attacked this small Jewish nation. So in 1952, you had what is called really the birth of Arab nationalism. The Arabs wanted to drive the British and the French out of the Middle East. And Gamal Abdel Nasser became the president of Egypt. In 1956, he seized the Suez Canal. That led to the Suez conflict. The British, the French, and the Israelis went in to get the Suez Canal back. President Eisenhower forced them out. That was the loss of the Suez Canal, the end of the British Empire, the withdrawal of the British and the French from the Middle East. The next major turning point in the Middle East was in the late 1970s, in 1979. In fact, 25 years ago exactly, last month, was the fall of the Shah of Iran. What happened here was we saw a new force that took over. You see, prior to 1979, it was Arab nationalism which was the driving force in the Middle East. In Egypt in 1952, the king was overthrown. In Iraq in 1956, their king was overthrown, and the whole royal family was murdered. And that led to Saddam Hussein coming to power. And then you saw this happening in other countries. In 1969, the king of Libya was overthrown. You see, people thought the kings were too pro-Western. And so they wanted nationalist governments, Arab nationalist governments, that put Arabs first. They wanted to be led by people who were genuine Arabs, not by kings who were educated in British schools and sometimes had Western ways. But within a generation, they were disillusioned with Arab nationalists because they became just as decadent as the kings were, just as corrupt. And the countries never seemed to get anywhere economically, and there was lots of unemployment. And this is where Islamic fundamentalism comes in, because people started to turn back to the Islamic religion, and they wanted to go back to the Islamic religion in its purest form, and they see that as the solution to their problems. Now, Iran is not an Arab country. Iran's in the Middle East, but it's not an Arab country. And most of the Arabs in the Middle East are Sunni Muslims, which is the majority of Muslims. About 85% of the Muslims in the world are Sunnis. The people in Iran are Shia Muslims, or Shiites, which accounts for about 15% of Muslims. And, you know, you might want to compare that to Catholicism and Protestantism. You know, the Shiites broke away from the Sunnis after Muhammad died, and so you've had these two branches of Islam. And the Shiites tend to be lesser educated and tend to be, more strict in some ways. But the strictest sect of Islam is the Sunni sect of Wahhabism, which is in Saudi Arabia. I know this gets a bit confusing, and you can read up on this yourself, but Saudi Arabia they are followers of Wahhabism. That goes back to the 18th century, and it is the most militant sect of Islam. I think it was 16 of the 19 hijackers on September the 11th were from this one sect, the Wahhabi sect, or maybe it was all of them, I can't remember. But anyway, in fact, probably it was all of them. Because I remember reading sometime later that all the terrorists so far have been from the Wahhabi sect of Islam. But Islamic fundamentalism we first witnessed in Iran 25 years ago. The Shah of Iran, the King of Iran, was very pro-American. America had been arming him and looking to him and his country to police this whole region of the Persian Gulf, which is extremely important, because that is where most of the oil in the world is. And of course, without oil, our economies would collapse. For some reason, God has placed oil in hot, primitive, contentious places like the Persian Gulf, Nigeria, Gabon, places like that, Texas, the places that nobody wants to go to. So in 1979, you saw the Shah overthrown and Islamic fundamentalists took over. And really, we should have been warned. We should have known that this was going to be a major problem. But what were we obsessed with at the time? We were obsessed with this up here, the USSR. Okay? Communism was the big threat. And so we were in the Cold War, and we thought that our enemy was communism. But meanwhile, there's this new enemy that's starting, Islamic fundamentalism. Now, this is where things get confusing. You see, over here, we have Afghanistan. Now, in 1979, the same year that the Shah was overthrown here, in 1979, the Russians invaded Afghanistan. Afghanistan's king was overthrown in 1973. And Afghanistan had a period of chaos, and eventually there was a communist-type government in Afghanistan. And that was overthrown, and that was the pretext for the Russians to invade. So the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan in 1979, and they fought a war there for 10 years. During that time, because our enemy was communism, we sent help to the Afghan resistance called the Taliban, which was led by Osama bin Laden. And we supplied him with arms in the hope that he could kick the Russians out. We sent those arms through Pakistan, which is an Islamic nation. Well, of course, eventually the Russians were kicked out in 1989, and that war directly led to the fall of the Soviet Union. For the same reasons as we saw the British Empire fall and the French Empire and the Spanish Empire, imperial overreach. The Russians were overextended militarily, and, you know, their finances were really bad. It was a very unproductive economic system, and so eventually it just collapsed, just as other great empires have collapsed before it. And today what has replaced it is different. Now the country broke up, and, you know, a number of parts of the Soviet Union now are independent countries. But let's get back to, you know, Islamic fundamentalism. Osama bin Laden, who comes originally from Saudi Arabia and is a billionaire, I mean, his family is one of the wealthiest families in Saudi Arabia. So ignore the comment that is often made by liberals. They will often tell you that the cause of all these problems is poverty. And if we could just help all these people to have color TVs and, you know, stereos and everything, everything would be fine. But that isn't the case, because Osama and his boys are all extremely wealthy. Okay, so poverty is not the only factor here. Now, it may be a reason why many people follow Islamic fundamentalism, but it is not the primary problem here. Osama bin Laden is said to have had a vision similar to Muhammad's vision. If we can go back to the map of the 7th century, I want to show you here, just go back here, or maybe we go forward to the map of the... Here we are, okay. Here's the map of the 7th century. There were two great empires at the time of Muhammad, okay? Over here, you had the Persian Empire, starting, you know, roughly here and going all over there, okay? Then you had the Byzantine Empire up here, Turkey and that area there. And Muhammad had a dream that the two greatest empires in the world would be destroyed by this new religion, that he would bring about the collapse of this new religion. And although it was not fulfilled in his lifetime, it was fulfilled. The new religion of Islam brought about the collapse of the Persian Empire and the Byzantine Empire. Within 10 years of his death, both were defeated in battles. The Byzantine Empire hung on for a few hundred years, finally collapsed completely, but the Persian Empire collapsed earlier. Anyway, so the dream was fulfilled, the vision was fulfilled. Osama bin Laden is said to have had a similar vision. His vision is that he would bring about the collapse of the two greatest empires in the world, the Soviet Union and the United States. One down, one to go. See, that's the dream of his followers. They brought down the Soviet Union, they're going to bring down the United States as well. And, you know, we are a very fragile society because, you know, our wealth, our strength depends upon, you know, certain factors. I mean, we depend upon cheap oil, for example, and much of our oil, and certainly the world price of oil, is determined by what happens around here. And, you know, that's a major weakness that we've got, that we need so much oil from other parts of the world. And then, of course, our economy is based on confidence. And a lot of confidence was lost after September the 11th. If we have another September the 11th, what's going to happen? Let's say we have another one, and then another one, and then another one. When I lived in Rhodesia during the terrorist war there, our first terrorist attack was in 1966. Our second one was in 1972, December of 72. But after the second one, the third one came very quickly, and the fourth came even quicker, and the fifth came even quicker after that. And eventually we were having terrorist attacks, you know, every single day, more than one each day. And the war lasted 7 years, and finally the country just collapsed. And I'm not saying things will go exactly the same way for the U.S., but, you know, I'm sure we have a lot more terrorism up ahead, and that certainly ties in with Deuteronomy 28. And realize there's another factor here, too. You know, right up until 1965, here we come back to immigration again, okay? Right up until 1965, America had a policy, its immigration policy, was based upon maintaining the racial balance within the U.S., which had worked successfully to a great extent. I mean, you know, not perfectly by any means, but it had worked greatly until 65, and there was certainly peace. So the policy was based on maintaining that racial balance. But in 1965, as one of those great reforms or deforms of the 1960, Senator Kennedy, a fine, upstanding Christian gentleman, proposed a change in immigration policy that instead of favoring peoples from Western Europe, Protestant peoples from Western Europe, every country in the world should be treated the same. And so the maximum number of immigrants from each country would be 20,000 people. 20,000 from Britain, 20,000 from Germany, 20,000 from France, 20,000 from Ghana, 20,000 from Haiti, 20,000 from Cuba, etc. Actually, Cuba, because the communists have taken over, there's an unlimited number from Cuba. But this led to significant changes, and one of the changes was, in the 1970 census, there were 500,000 people in America who were Muslims. Now there are 12 million. And of even greater interest in what is happening now, I mentioned the Wahhabi sect of Islam. The Saudis believe, because they are the ones who protect Mecca and Medina, the two most holy sites of Islam, the Saudis, with their oil wealth, finance mosques around the world. And those mosques educate Islamic children. In fact, they are indoctrinated with Islam before they ever go to public school. They have to learn the Quran in Arabic before they go to public school. They start at the age of 3. And they send out imams, clerics from Saudi Arabia to all the mosques around the world. And because of our tradition of freedom of religion, they come to America. And I have read in at least 2 different sources that 80% of all the imams in America, of all the clerics in America, are Wahhabis. 80%. And the Wahhabis are the most violent of all, and believe that they have to bring about the fall of our way of life, of our whole society. So we have the reverse of the American experience here. In the American experience, generally when immigrants come to America, the first generation may still consider themselves more Swedish or more German or more French or whatever. But their children usually become very American. I mean, I've seen this with my own children too. My own children even like football. And, you know, I've been here 14 years and I still don't like it. But the reverse is happening now. The second generation of Muslim immigrants, and I'm not talking about all of them, you know, but I'm talking about a significant number. The second generation of Muslim immigrants, the ones born here, are more anti-American than their parents because of the indoctrination that they're receiving in the mosque. There's a lot of books on this subject. Daniel Pipes is one author I would recommend here, P-I-P-E-S, who wrote a book recently, Militant Islam Reaches America. And, you know, let me just point out to you here, you know, Britain in the 1970s and 80s had a major problem with the IRA, the Irish Republican Army, and often they brought England to a standstill because of their terrorist attacks. And some were absolutely horrendous, bombs on trains, bombs in pubs, bombs in shopping malls, you know, which killed dozens of people, and people lived in absolute fear. British intelligence afterwards, after this reign of terror ended, revealed that even at the worst moment, there were only 200 active IRA terrorists in the British Isles, 200. But they brought the country sometimes to a grinding halt. Now, America's population is 5 times Britain, so roughly. So let's say 1,000 terrorists in the U.S. could do as much damage as was done by the IRA in Britain. 1,000. We have 12 million Muslims. Some of them are converts, by the way. The Nation of Islam is mostly people who are converts. In fact, in Jackson Prison in Michigan, 1/3 of the prisoners are Muslims. Mostly converts. Realize too, and Daniel Pipe shows this in his book, that roughly 15% of Muslims are fundamentalists, who are willing to use violence to achieve their ends. So let's say 15% of 10 million is 1.5 million. So we could have 1.5 million potential terrorists right there. The numbers of Muslims in the country, by the way, is an estimate of 12 million. It's maybe closer to 10, but some sources say 12. You know, it just depends. Who knows? Josh. Who was behind the beast powers? The dragon gave him his power. Revelation 13. No, I don't necessarily feel it's going to be fulfilled just because he has a vision. No, I don't think that. I'm just saying this is the driving force, the enthusiasm, if you like, behind their movement. They feel they're going to bring about the collapse of the United States, as well as the Soviet Union. But I don't think it has to be fulfilled simply because Osama got a vision from a satanic demon. No. Okay. Let's just wrap up here because we've only got a few minutes. Remember, in Daniel chapter 11, we had a prophecy about the kings of the north and the king of the south. And this prophecy suddenly jumps from the ancient world to the modern world in verse 40, when it says, at the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him. Well, remember, in the modern world, you've got the state of Israel, the Jews again. In the ancient world, you had the Jews there. But this prophecy ends, and then suddenly takes this great big jump. And, you know, the reason is because there was no Jewish state in the Middle East during that period of time for almost 2,000 years. Now we've got the Jews back. There were Israelites back in that area again, and it's become a central focus of world affairs again. The king of the south, remember, were the Ptolemies in Egypt. The kings of the north were the Seleucid dynasty in what is now Syria, extending considerably far east. Now we see the king of the south again and the king of the north. At the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him, or push at him, is one phrase that is used. And the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots, horsemen, and with many ships. While to the south of Jerusalem, we have all these Islamic powers. Now, admittedly, there are Islamic powers to the north as well. But, the problem areas, Egypt is half the Arabs. I mean, Egypt alone, okay? If Egypt, for example, fell to Islamic fundamentalism, that would change things considerably. If Saudi Arabia, which is the wealthiest of all the Arab countries, fell to Islamic fundamentalism, things would change considerably. Osama bin Laden comes from Saudi Arabia, and a lot of people are followers of Osama. In fact, many members of the Saudi royal family are supporters of Osama bin Laden. But gradually what we've been seeing since 1979, since the Ayatollahs took over Iran in 1979, what we've been seeing gradually is the spread of Islamic fundamentalism. And, I think we can speculate here that the king of the south is going to be a leader who puts together some Islamic fundamentalist forces here and then pushes against the north, the king of the north, being the revived Roman Empire, the resurrected beast power, which depends on this area for oil. Germany, France, etc., depend on this area for oil. Perhaps the push, the attack, could be terrorism. Perhaps it could be the oilist cut off. Who knows what it might be? Iraq is interesting in this context because we went into Iraq because we believed there were weapons of mass destruction there. It seems that there weren't. They might have been moved out. There might not have been any. We may never know the whole truth, okay? That doesn't mean to say that those who took us in made it all up. These things sometimes are just unclear. But what is interesting is we may have actually created a bigger problem in Iraq than we solved. Because Iraq basically divides into three factions. There are the Kurds in the north. There are the Sunni Muslims in the middle, and there are the Shiites, who were mostly in the south. In Iraq as a whole, the Shiites are the majority. If we, the United States and Britain, who are committed to giving Iraq a democratic government, if we allow a totally democratic election, a totally free election where every vote is equal, it will inevitably result in a Shiite victory in Iraq. The Shiites already control Iran, which is a radical theocratic state. It is a country run by the church. That's a theocratic nation. The Ayatollahs, the religious leaders in Iran, are the ones who are in charge. They just had an election in Iran, and there were thousands of candidates put their names forward for election, and the Ayatollahs refused to allow 2,500 of those candidates to stand for election because they were not strict enough Muslims. So naturally, the government that was voted into office is a very strict Islamic government. And that is democracy Iranian style. Well, we could see the same thing happen in Iraq. So we may actually, by removing Saddam Hussein, who was not a religious man, we may have opened the door for a religious government in Iraq, which would be against our own interests as a nation. And of course, the Shiites in Iraq, the Shiites in Iran may come together, and so Islamic fundamentalism has spread even more. Another key to all of this is Pakistan, which you see just here, Pakistan. General Musharraf is the president of Pakistan at this time. He's supporting the United States in the war against terrorism. But a lot of people think he is the only person in Pakistan who's supporting the United States again in the war against terrorism, because it seems like everybody else in the country is an Islamic fundamentalist, or at least that they are very anti-American. And, you know, it's always being said that Osama bin Laden is somewhere around here in the northwest frontier of Pakistan, or up here in the northwest frontier, rather, that's West Pakistan, somewhere along the Pakistan-Afghanistan border. And, you know, it's not likely that we're going to be able to get him because the people in that area support him. But it's not just there that they support him. Just go through these maps. I'll show you a picture here if I can find it. Looking for it here. Okay. Oh, maybe I haven't got it. Looks like I haven't got it. I had a picture of Osama bin Laden at the side of the road in Ghana. They have pictures of him for sale all over the place. He appeals to people in the third world. One of our pastors, who was a Muslim, put it this way. He said, Muslims believe that America is trying to take over the world and Osama bin Laden will stop them. So he appeals to people, even those who are not Muslims, because they think he's the only person that can bring America down. Why don't they like America? Because of our TV programs, our entertainment, our standards, our way of life, which is not our way of life in this room. You know, they used to respect us as a nation because we were a religious people. But now that we are a degenerate people, and now they see us as, you know, they see all this pornography that comes out of America. They see all these movies, all this music. They see how it affects their children. So the hatred of the United States increases. And it's only going to increase even more if we start and have Mr. and Mr. Smith living together. Sorry, Tyler. He's called Smith. You know, if we have same-sex marriages, they're going to hate us even more. Why am I showing this map? Remember, if you can just click on the British Empire map, let's have a contrast here. The British Empire, okay. That was the world in 1946. Now let's go to that map that I just had there. This is the Islamic world today. Everything colored green there is Islam. You see how the world has changed in my lifetime? 1946, the US and Britain dominated the world, the tribe of Joseph. These countries did not exist at that time. Most of these countries were ruled either by Britain or France, or in Libya it was Italy, and a lot of them were ruled by the Russians, Kazakhstan, all those up there. They only got their independence in 1991, 92, when the Soviet Union collapsed. So you see how everything has changed? We've gone from a world after World War II where Islam was not a factor in world affairs to this, where Islam is a major factor in the world. But the struggle between Islam and the Western way of life goes right back to the 7th century when Islam started and spread all across North Africa and got right up there into Europe. And this struggle between Islam and Christianity, and I'm not talking about real Christianity, I'm talking about mainstream Christianity, the struggle between Islam and Christianity goes back 14 centuries, and it has often resulted in conflict. The greatest period of conflict was the Crusades in the 12th century, when Catholic forces went into the Middle East and clashed with the forces of Islam. And, you know, since then we've had other examples. In the 17th century, for example, Muslim forces tried to take Central Europe, and there was a war. But then, with the rise of the tribe of Joseph, Islam was pushed back, you see, because we had the ascendancy. But with the decline of the tribe of Joseph since World War II, Islam has risen again. That's why we had September the 11th, and why this now is going to be a major factor in the years or decades to come. You see how the world's changed.